Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness, Pujya Swami Chidananda Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India.
This is an affliction of not only youth in college, this is an affliction of everyone. So many people say, oh, I didn't mean that. Right? You say something, somebody takes offense, you say, nee, wo to mera matlab nahi tha. To kya matlab tha fir? So many of us constantly are saying, oh, I didn't mean this, I didn't mean that. Our words are a very precious power. This varni, this power of speech, is a great power. And it's not something to take lightly. We have become just habitual talkers. Meaning we don't pay any attention to what we say at all. We just keep talking. Because it's just become a habit. We just talk and we talk and we talk. And when we don't actually have something to say, we talk about nothing. That's when we end up saying things we don't mean, hurting people, hurting ourselves, and developing habits that, as you say, later on, we've come into this habit. It's also a huge dissipation of energy. That ojas in the body, that pran, that sacred life force, these energies of the body, we're not supposed to just throw them away. And this habitual just talking is actually a great waste of the energy of the being. In the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagwan Krishna says, tapas of speech, right speech, is that which is true, kind, and beneficial. True, kind, and beneficial. And I've also, in recent years, heard some other teachers add a fourth criterion. Does it improve upon the silence? That when you're going to speak something, you actually have to ask yourself, is it true? Is it kind? Is it beneficial? And does it improve upon the silence? And if any of those four answers is no, well, then we have this great gift of being silent. Silence is not a weakness. Silence does not mean ki kutahi ni kenega. Silence is a strength. Like fasting. Fasting is not a weakness. Fasting doesn't mean that I can't figure out what to eat. Fasting is a strength. It means that even with the call of my body saying eat, I've made a decision. I'm fasting. In the same way, when from inside it's saying, say this, say that, say this, and we are choosing silence because we know that what we're saying isn't true, kind, beneficial, that's a great strength. Now, in college, but also amidst any kind of social situation, there's, as you say, vocabularies. There's words that get used, slang words, colloquial words, profanity. And as you say, you don't mean it in that way. But what you'll find is, sadly, it does become a habit. It's an impression. An impression upon us. Because when you say something, you're listening to it as well. You're hearing yourself say it, which means that you now, on a very subtle level, identify as, yeah, I'm someone who talks like that. And that becomes a very detrimental self-identification. You mentioned, you know, when I'm with my friends, we don't have any control over what we say. So, you're a spiritual young man. I've had the wonderful joy of seeing you here for the last several days. You're a really beautiful spiritual young man. Don't let yourself off the hook quite so easily of just, well, though it wasn't in my control, I have no control. That's a really detrimental pattern to set up for your life. Because if you tell yourself now, well, when I'm around my friends, I don't have control over my vocabulary. Well, then what's to say you don't have control over what you drink, or what you smoke, or what you eat, or what you do? I mean, then these become excuses throughout our lives of, yeah, I did it because I was with those people, and they were doing it. And it just ends up becoming these ways of thinking that who I am is just part of this group. Groups are wonderful. A sangha is wonderful. It's very important. But you need to maintain your own values in that sangha. And in the same way that if you're a pukka vegetarian and they're eating meat, you're not going to say, well, tokana para, I had to eat it, I had no control. Everybody was eating hamburgers. You would say, I'm a vegetarian. In the same way, let your speech become vegetarian. And if anybody likes you less because you're not using those vocabulary, they're not really friends to begin with. You don't have to become the guru of the group. I'm not saying you should start telling everybody else what to say. Don't say anything. They're not looking for a guru. Don't become theirs. Don't worry about it. Be their friend. But at least you use words that are in alignment with your own values. And if anybody says to you, why did you use that nice vegetarian word instead of this profanity? Well, then you should feel strong enough to say to them, I've decided that I like my speech to be vegetarian also. And if they give you a hard time about it, then as difficult as it is, that really becomes the time to reevaluate the friendships. In the same way that if they're drinking alcohol and you don't want to drink alcohol, and they pressure you and they make you feel badly for not drinking. Well, that's not the right samaj. You want to be with friends who love and respect you for who you are. And so if it's troubling you in such a way that you bring it in here because you know it's there, it's in your heart, it's troubling you, speak from your heart. Use the words you want to use. There's plenty of words. I mean, the English language has plenty of words. The Hindi language has God knows how many more possible permutations. You've got 52 letters compared to our 26. Make up your own word. Invent a new word if you want. For something that could be used instead of that profanity. But don't allow yourself to get into a lifelong habit of, I have no control when I'm around my friends. Learn how to carry yourself Otherwise, those habits become your character, and your character becomes your destiny. So you're literally starting to create a destiny. Words are things. Words are not just words. Words are an energy put out into the universe. There's a power to them. This is the power when we talk about the power of mantra. Well, it's not just what the mantra means. I mean, if you look at actually the meanings of most of the mantras we chant, most of them is basically just, oh, divine in this form with this name, I bow to you. That's pretty much the translation of almost all of the mantras, or different forms of the divine. But, oh, divine in this form, fill in the blank, I bow to you. What's powerful about them is that alchemic power of the sound, the power of the word. That power of the word is huge. Grab it, use it. Don't find yourself out of control. So if you're finding yourself in a situation where you have to keep speaking just to keep the other person from speaking, I would reevaluate the friendship. If you're in a situation where you're looking for a way to make the other person essentially stop talking, that might be a really good moment to ask yourself, why am I even in this relationship? If I have to essentially overshout them, take back the control of this conversation, why are you wasting your time anyway? And by the way, just because someone's saying something doesn't mean that we have to respond or react. Let them speak. If you've got to be there when they're done, you respond in your way of peace, love, truth, whatever you're anchored in, your values. But don't get yourself in situations where because of some sense of responsibility or out of controlness of the relationship. Unko chupana padega. These are not relationships you want to hold on to. Jahan chupana padega kisi ko. You want to be in relationships with people you want to listen to, not people you want to shut up. Okay? Yeah. Find yourself some good friends.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me.
When I meet spiritually elevated souls, people, gurus, tears flow down my face and I am tongue-tied. I am not able to ask questions in my mind. Why does this happen? Is the drishti too powerful. Please explain why. Questions are of the mind. The mind is the only part of us that's troubled. Sometimes we say, my heart feels this. But the truth is, it's in the brain. It's in the mind. Now, yes, we also have these beautiful energy centers. I won't go into all about it now. We'll talk more about the different chakras as the Navaratri begins. And each day as we celebrate a different form of the Mother Goddess, we'll talk about the chakra that she's associated with. So yes, we do feel, of course, in our heart chakra and that energy center, but ultimately all of the thinking takes place in the mind. The heart experiences love for sure, oneness for sure, on a deep level. The mind is the calculated one. The mind that's the 50-50, what I've done for you, what am I getting, give and take. That's games of the mind. Now, the mind also functions only in separation. The mind sees everything as separate from itself. The heart knows oneness. And I mention this because when we are in a moment in which our hearts open in the presence of a master, a guru, on the banks of Ganga, in so many deep, spiritually elevating experiences, our minds just shut down. And that's a good thing, by the way. That's not problematic. It allows us to drop fully into the heart. And in many of those cases, we don't make any kind of conscious choice. It just happens. The heart explodes, tears pour down our eyes. And lo and behold, the thinking mind that is troubled is quiet. I remember when I first came to the banks of Ganga and first had this incredible experience. For days, I was pretty much nonverbal. And I mean, I was a straight-A student. I was an academic. I was the one who ended up teaching classes when the teacher didn't show up or was out sick. So for me, nonverbal was not a state that, unless I was sleeping, I pretty much ever found myself in. And I was nonverbal. I mean, all I could say for days as tears poured down my eyes was, oh my God, it's so beautiful. Oh my God, it's so beautiful. Oh my God, it's so beautiful. So to find yourself at a loss for words, especially a loss for words that center around something that is troubling your mind, is neither surprising nor problematic. It's very natural. As you've dropped into an open heart, the mind quiets. And then, of course, there's also that grace that happens sometimes where our questions just disappear. I remember when I first met Pooja Swamiji, first had his darshan, he would meet people for an hour at a time, 2 hours a day, 10:30 to 11:30 in the morning, and it was either 4 to 5 or 4:30 to 5:30 in the afternoons. And on the rare occasions that the hour ended before the people ended, he would turn to me because I would just come and sit and just be there and absorb his presence. And I, of course, found myself, if not completely nonverbal, at least not very articulate, not nearly as articulate as I would like to be. And I found it embarrassing because I always had questions. I always had things to ask. But when he would turn to me and say, yes, I couldn't think of anything. And then, of course, afterwards, later on, things would come to me. And so I would kind of make these mental lists of next time he asks me, here's going to be my very intelligent question I'm going to ask him. And then he would turn to me and say, yes. And my brain was, you know, like oatmeal, just nothing. And I finally decided, all right, this is really embarrassing. I'm going to write them down. So I made a list in my room one night of questions. And I used to have a little purse that was just one of these little cloth embroidered ones that I had bought here in the market, that small. All I had to carry around were my room keys and some chapstick and maybe, you know, some rupees to get a cup of tea or something. And I put my questions in my purse and come in for darshan. And he turns to me and says, yes. And I'm ecstatic because I've got my list of questions. And I open my purse and they're gone. Now, my purse had no pockets. It wasn't like a proper handbag of a busy woman, you know, with all kinds of things in it. It was a tiny little cloth bag. My keys were there. My chapstick was there. My rupees were there. No list. No secret compartments. No nothing in the purse. And so then I decide, well, I must have lost it along the way. And I go back out and I'm retracing my steps back to my room. It's not there. I knew it was there. I had just put it in my purse. I say to Pujaswamiji before I go, can you just give me 2 minutes? I'll be right back. And I get into my room and I start literally tossing my room, like as though somehow, without me remembering it, my list had ended up under my mattress or in my pillowcase or, you know, in my... It's nowhere. And I finally realized, oh, okay, I get it, universe. This is not going to be about what you do well, which is intellectual mind stuff. This is a whole new ballgame, a whole new situation. And no, you don't get to rely on that thinking mind, on your powers of intellect, on that, in this new situation. That this is now a situation of an open heart, not an overactive mind. So that's another thing that sometimes happens to questions. And when it does, we let them go. I mean, questions are beautiful. It's why we have satsang. It's what enables us to go deeper. But this is why I say so frequently, there's no such thing as a silly question. There's no such thing as a wrong question. As long as it's deeply meaningful for you, and it's something that is in some way blocking you on your path. But what a lot of us tend to do is we like to kind of show how philosophically smart we are, and use question times as a way to just allow our minds to play games. And those are the questions that tend to disappear in that divine presence. So don't worry when it happens to you. It's a beautiful thing.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Mike Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip or the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation.
What if a person does not even realize that he is an angry person? How can he work on his anger when he thinks he is not an angry man? So the very first step in working on anything is awareness. I can't quit smoking if I deny that I smoke. I can't quit drinking if I deny that I drink. I can't quit lying if I deny that I lie. And if I deny that I am impacted by, driven by different emotions, whether it's anger, greed, lust, jealousy, ego, all of the stuff that most of us inside say, I'm not that. I'm not that. Well, then we can't actually become free of them. And this is why it's really important to realize there's no shame in any of this. This is part of the human condition. And if you believe in a perfect God, a God who certainly could have created us without any anger or greed or lust or jealousy, but didn't. I mean, to me, God is perfect. And if God wanted me to be born without any struggle, God would have waved God's magic wand, and that's exactly how I would have been born. But because I believe in a perfect God, a perfect creator, I believe in a perfect creation. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't work to do, but doing the work is part of the perfection. Because it's bringing us back into awareness with the perfection of who we really are, which is these spiritual beings having a human experience in a human body. Which is perfect. If God didn't want us to have a human body, we would not have a human body. But the key is awareness. And this is why removing the whole shame element around spirituality is so important. Because we can't grow if I'm denying and repressing and suppressing. Then I can't grow. And so, this is why a practice of awareness and mindfulness is so important. Because I may be able to say to you, oh, I'm not angry. I mean, how many times have we ever said to someone, calm down? And they say, I'm calm, what do you mean? You think, oh, that was helpful, okay. People say it all the time, or you say, you know, don't be angry. I'm not angry. Okay. Now, it may be apparent to the person you're talking to that you are not calm, that you're angry. But if it's not apparent to you, then you're just going to keep repeating the same cycles over and over and over again. And that's why we practice mindfulness. It's why we watch first the breath, the easiest place to start. But as we watch the breath, we also watch emotions arise. You can see anger arising. It doesn't arise out of the blue. If you're really aware, you see it start to build. You feel it. The heart starts to beat a little faster. The face starts to get a little flushed. The vision starts to get a little narrow. So we have to acknowledge these aspects of ourselves without shame, recognizing that we're all here doing the work to come back to the truth, to know the truth, but simply denying something does not actually make it go away. If you are, as it sounds from the question, like the friend, the loved one, the companion of someone, because of course the question was in the third person, not the first, so it sounds like they're asking about another person in their life. The challenge is that the more you say you are an angry man, the more angry they're going to get, and the less likely they are to admit it and acknowledge it. And this is where maybe simply dropping the idea of trying to convince them they're angry, but instead bring in some spiritual practices that you could do together. Start a daily meditation. And if he doesn't want to do it, no problem, you do it. You do it. Invite him each day. Travel together to holy places, listen to satsang, have darshan of saints, go to katha. And slowly, slowly, slowly bring him into more and more spiritual places. And help him understand. But until and unless someone acknowledges it, unfortunately, there's not much you can do. And the last piece, though, is to realize, you know, everybody's on their own karmic journey. And not to judge someone else's. The universe is infinitely patient. You don't learn it this life, you'll learn it next life. You don't learn it next life, you'll learn it the life after that. And so not everyone may be necessarily on your timeline. And if someone really can't see something, no matter how much you try to show them, whether it's about their emotions, whether it's about God, divinity, spirituality, consciousness, don't judge. Because that just makes you fall back on your path. That just creates separation in your mind. Give yourself the beautiful spiritual challenge of, can you love someone who may be at a different stage of a karmic journey without any judgment of what's better or worse, higher or lower? No spiritual arrogance here. Just just a love for wherever that person may be. And the truth is that a loving, accepting, spacious presence is the very best environment for someone actually to start doing their work. You can't do it with that agenda, though. But just so that you know, unconditional love, tender spaciousness is the place in which people blossom and open and unfold. But you need to be prepared to love them anyway, because that's your journey. Your work is, because remember, they've been sent to you. You've been sent to them. You've been karmically drawn to each other. And maybe the lesson for you in this is not, how can I make him less angry? How can I teach him? But how can I learn to love in the face of anger? How can I learn not to make my self-identity based on what he says? Because these are important lessons.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times. Co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin, with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation.
Bhakti Yoga. Path of devotion. So, for me, it really happened very spontaneously. I was raised in a Reform Jewish community. We were not religious. We went to synagogue because it mattered to my grandparents. First Friday evening of every month was family night. Grandma wanted to go to synagogue. We all went to synagogue. The holidays and observances that we celebrated were ones that were focused much more on the history, the culture, the ancestors, than actually on God. But as a 25-year-old academic, it never occurred to me that I was missing anything. It never occurred to me that I should be loving God. God was a nameless, formless being whom I feared occasionally. Not much. I mean, I didn't move through my life afraid of God, but, you know, occasionally on holidays where God was making important decisions, I was afraid. When I came to India and had this powerful experience of awakening, my heart just burst open in love. That's why the only thing I could say was, oh my God, it's so beautiful. Oh my God, it's so beautiful. Now, there wasn't at the time an object of my love. I mean, it didn't matter what I was looking at. A telephone pole, literally. Telephone poles, pillars. There used to be these marble pillars on the ghat that have since been removed to make more room for seating. But we had these marble pillars, and I used to look at them. The steps, people, random people, didn't matter. Whatever I saw was so beautiful because I was seeing God everywhere. But as time went on, I developed love experiences for different forms of God. I remember my love for Krishna began on a trip that Swamiji took me on. He was going down to Vrindavan. I had been here maybe 3-4 weeks. I had never heard of Vrindavan. I didn't know anything. I'm sure I had heard of Krishna, but I didn't really know anything. And he was going on this trip that was part of a huge, beautiful yatra called the Vraj Yatra that was being led by these other two beautiful saints. And we went down. He said to me, do you want to go? And again, I didn't know where we were going, but it didn't matter where we were going. I mean, if he had said, you know, I'm on my way to hell, would you like to join me? I would have been like, yeah, you're going to be there, right? So I said, yes, of course, I want to go. And we got there, and we were there for the day of doing the parikrama, the on foot walking around the mountain of Govardhan, which is a very sacred mountain in the stories of Bhagavan Krishna. And people do a pilgrimage around it, and it's 21 kilometers, and you go barefoot. And we did it in this huge, huge group of people, this huge yatra. And everybody kept asking me, I was the only foreigner there, and everybody kept asking me, are your feet okay? Are your feet okay? And I remember being so perplexed because I had no idea I had feet. I mean, I felt like I was floating, that I was being carried. Feet? Like, what are feet? Why are you asking me this question? And I was so full of love of God. And we went shortly thereafter to the ashram of one of the saints who had been running the pilgrimage in a place called Ramanreti. Now, Ramanreti literally means the reet, the sand of Bhagavan Krishna. And the ashram is built on that sand. And I remember lying and rolling around in the sand with just tears pouring down my eyes. And I had no idea what was happening to me. I hadn't read the Srimad Bhagavatam. I hadn't read the Mahabharata. I hadn't even read the Bhagavad Gita by that point. I didn't know anything. I didn't have any framework in which to put this. But the experiences of love were so powerful that suddenly I started loving Krishna. In fact, when I learned about mantras, and I decided I wanted one. And I went to Pooja Swamiji and I asked him to give me a mantra. And he made me wait. He didn't tell me why. He just said, not yet. And I would keep going and he would say, not yet. And I decided, well, I wasn't going to deprive myself of the benefit of a mantra just because my guru wouldn't give me one. And so I made up a mantra. And my mantra was, I love you, Krishna. And I used to do my japa with I love you, Krishna for 2 years until Pooja Swamiji finally granted me an actual Sanskrit mantra. So for me, that devotion just blossomed in that way. And then my love for Hanumanji blossomed one night, as funny as it sounds, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I had gone to see Pooja Swamiji. It was after he had sent me back to America to finish studies, and I had finished them, and he was in Pittsburgh where he had built the Hindu Jain temple and was spearheading the Encyclopedia of Hinduism project. And I went to meet him there. And he said to me one evening there, he said, you are going to do great things. You're going to touch millions. And I remember thinking that it sounded the way that my mother would say, you're the prettiest girl in the class. You know, like, you know it's not true, but you appreciate the love of the one who's saying it to you to make you feel happy. But you don't actually suddenly start thinking you're the prettiest girl in the class just because your mother told you you were. And in the same way, I remember when Pooja Swamiji said that, thinking, oh, that's so sweet. You know, he's trying to make me feel good. And I said to him, you know, I know that I'm intelligent. I know that I'm going to be able to do something. But I know that I'm not at that level, as you say, and that's okay. Like, you don't have to, you know, say these nice things that so obviously are not true. And he was quiet, and the next morning when I got up and went up to do pranam to him, sitting on the table where he was sitting was a book about this thick of the Ramayana. And it was an English translation, not a verse-by-verse translation, but it was more of the story of the Ramayana. Not quite for kids, but nonetheless a really easy version. It was the Bhartiya Vidya Bhavan version of Ramayana. And he gave it to me to read. I read it during the day. I ended up staying awake all night reading it. And by the next morning, I had finished it. And I went to him the next morning with just tears pouring down my face. And I said, I get it. I get it. If Hanumanji could accomplish and achieve all of these miraculous feats just out of devotion to God, because that's what Hanumanji says. When he gets asked at the end of the war, how did you do it? How did you fly across the ocean? How did you carry the Himalayas in your hand? How did you put the sun under your armpit? Like, how did you do these things? He didn't say, well, don't you know who I am? He didn't say, you know, I've been working out at the gym and I've got this special trainer and he's teaching me the carry the mountains pose. He didn't say I've got some very special vitamin tonic, nothing. He just said, I take Bhagwan Ram's name, I take God's name, I think of God, I invoke God. And it happens. It happens. And so I said to Pooja Swamiji, I said, I get it. It's not about him and what he can do. It's about the grace of God. It's about the miracle of God. And so if through taking God's name, this essentially monkey could accomplish all that, well, then maybe I really can do something with my life. Maybe I really can accomplish something beautiful. And so from then on, my devotion for Hanumanji kept blossoming, of just make me that devotee like you are. Make me that devoted, that humble, that surrendered, that I know that A, I can do anything, and B, it's not about me, it's you. You can do anything. And if you want to, you can do it through me. But it's all about you. And so, Bhagwan Krishna, Hanumanji, Ganga, it's been a beautiful experience of bhakti. And, you know, it's interesting because in the teaching of Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, it's a teaching of non-duality. There's nothing but God. And so a lot of times these questions arise of, well, how do you worship God as somehow this form or that form? When there's nothing but God. Like, isn't that kind of a lower form of spirituality than this non-dual form? And the truth is that if you look throughout history at the bhaktas, the devotees, the enlightened saints, who were steeped in devotion, not only in India, not only in the Hindu tradition. You can find them in every tradition. Those lovers of God. Well, it's not that they don't know that they're one with God. It's not that they don't know that it's all God. It's not that somehow they haven't had that experience yet. It's that they choose to temporarily forget that because being in love is so beautiful. It's like I remember when I was learning fiction writing at Stanford, my professor said something that's always stuck with me. He said, "The world of fiction requires a willing suspension of disbelief. You have to willingly suspend your disbelief in order to enjoy fiction. If every time you read fiction, you say, that couldn't happen, well, that's impossible, well, I don't believe that, you'll never enjoy a good novel. It requires a willing suspension of disbelief." And I think that the practice of devotion requires a willing suspension of knowledge. That I'm willingly suspending temporarily that which I know on the deepest level to be true. Because being in love feels so beautiful. In the same way that I willingly suspend disbelief because I enjoy a good science fiction novel. And so on a much deeper level, I'm convinced, I mean, I haven't interviewed them, but I'm deeply convinced that all of the mystics, the sages, the saints, the lovers of God throughout history have made this very conscious, willing suspension of the fact that I know God is in me, is everywhere, and yet To love God is so beautiful that I am willing to forget that I know God is me so that I can experience this joy of loving God in a particular form, in a particular name, in a particular way.
This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on OM Times Radio.